Session number 6229, reel 4.
This is Collie Reel 3. Now, how did 15 people organise themselves to live in a garage?
Well, we lived in the garage during the day, but we were able to use... 8 of us went into the bedroom. I wonder now whether there were 2 bedrooms, because the Dutch people had...
Sorry, a garage with a bedroom?
A garage. And we used the bedroom at night for...
So that the house and the garage were an integral unit.
Yes.
And really, what you were living under, you were effectively living under the same roof with the Dutch people.
Yes.
Right. So.
Well, we at night it was we couldn't fit in 15 sleeping places in the garage, not with the best will in the world. Because if you need about 6 foot of space for 2 people, that's 12 feet across for people lying even foot to foot. And so 7 or 8 of us, 8 I think, went into one of the bedrooms in the bungalow. They were bungalows, and went into the bedroom just for the night. We didn't use it during the day. And we just lived, had our food, and had our being the whole of the day, and just went into the bedroom to sleep at night. And the garage had a rear door connecting the from which you could had access to the bathroom and the shower. There was only a shower. There wasn't a long bath, just a shower, which was in the lavatory. I mean, it was just combined shower and loo. And that accommodation, the lavatory accommodation, had 3 doors. There was one from the outside, which we used. There was one from one room and one from another room. I think one from our bedroom and one from another room, which all 3 led. And sometimes there was a queue at each door. You can imagine with 32 people, there was sometimes a queue, especially in the mornings, at each door. And it was a great strain, I must say.
Was the new house any better provided by way of furniture and equipment?
No. Well, of course, in the garage where we were, there was nothing, obviously. The house, as far as I can remember, there was a wooden settee, you know, the sort with wooden arms and wooden back with cushions, and I believe 1 or 2 chairs. I think there were some more books. No, there was very little, and certainly there was no cooking facility wired up or anything. We all had to cook out on bricks again.
Mm-hmm. Had there been any attempt in your arrival at Palembang by the Japanese to take any records of the internees who were imprisoned there?
Yes, they came... They kept, actually, we found that, well, it seemed like every few days somebody came round and demanding lists. You know, we began to groan and said, not another list, you know. They'd come and ask for lists. And they particularly wanted to know where we'd come from, what our husbands were or our family. And, of course, it worried us rather than a few military wives, because they wanted to know our husbands' ranks and the corps or regiments they were in. And of course, as military wives, we'd had no instructions as to what we ought to do in the way of giving information to an enemy. I mean, the men always knew as POWs. They just gave their rank and number, I believe, didn't they? You know, my rank is so-and-so, my number is so-and-so. And that was the lot. Well, nobody had ever thought of telling wives what they were supposed to do. So, of course, we just, I suppose, told the truth. It wasn't until later that I realised that perhaps we shouldn't have done. I can't think that it made much difference. But, you know, not having ever received any instructions on the point, we just told them, you know, what our husbands were and what regiments they were in. I think at first, you know, before we had time for afterthoughts, we thought it was beneficial because they might be told where we were. They might have information sent to them that where we were, that our husbands we thought to be interned in Singapore would probably be told. And I know at the time we thought it was rather a good idea to give information about our husband.
Was this information collected by means of a personal interrogation of each
journey? No, they gave us paper on which we had to write. It was passed round for us to write our own particulars down on it. You know, it was given to there was a spokeswoman. The doctor actually was sort of the spokeswoman, and they gave her the lists and told her to pass them round, and we all supplied our own information on lists of paper that they took. But this what happened constantly. We were giving this information, you know, over and over again. I don't know what they did with it all. Nothing, I think.
Were there any deficiencies in the camp that troubled you?
Well, we were never in any camp provided with any bedding of any description the whole time. They never suggested or offered us anything in the way of bedding. And as I say, most of the time we were lying on tiled floor, and some of the women were quite elderly, and there were young children, but nothing whatever was provided in the way of bedding. Mosquito nets, which really should have been provided, of course, we had none of those. And this was rather serious, especially when we went to camps where the mosquitoes were bad. And although so many of the women had come out of the sea and had virtually only the clothes they stood up in, they never provided us with any clothes. When we protested after we'd been there, I suppose about a year, we kept on at them to provide us with, if they would just provide us with material. And in the end, our crying need of most of the girls was to make shorts, which would have taken less material. And we asked for things for shorts. And eventually, after a while, they sent in enough to give us all a yard and a half of voile. Now, voile, for a man's point of view, is see-through light cotton material. Very flimsy cotton material in varied colours, which was completely unsuitable for what we wanted, even for sun tops, which we were practically all wearing by that time. It was impossible because it's transparent material, it's so thin, and we were begging for stuff to make shorts. We wouldn't have cared if it had been heavy drill material, anything that would have could have been made into shorts. But this was the only material, this yard and a half was the only material that they supplied all the time we were there. Eventually, those of us who had any money were able to buy some material from the a man who was allowed in the camp eventually to sell things, but they didn't provide us with anything.
As there were only women and children in the camp, I'm surprised that it troubled you that this material was see-through.
Yes, well, because of the guards, after all. We were constantly guarded by these men walking about. I mean, they used to walk into our bathhouses, anything. You never knew when you'd confront a Jap with his bayonet. Wherever you went, whatever you were doing, it would have been really most unsuitable. And the ironic part was that after we'd got very low in clothing, they had an inspection. We were told a general, a very high-placed Japanese general, was going to come and inspect the camp. And we were to clothe ourselves decently, not to go around, not to attempt to go on parade in our sun tops and shorts, which was complete irony, considering that was the only thing that most of them had to wear. How they thought we were going to produce clothes to wear just because there was a general coming. We had.
Could you tell me, in as much detail as you can remember, what the methods were by which the Japanese ran the camp?
Well, they didn't really do much about it at all, I don't think. They left it mostly to us. They sent in food. The idea was, they told us, they would send in food every day, which wasn't true. Sometimes we never knew when it was coming. and how much was coming. And when it came, although we asked, they didn't tell us, or they told us wrongly, how many days it was for. So sometimes when very much more than usual came in, which we realised was more than usual, we would say, but how long has this to last? And sometimes they would say, oh, more tomorrow. And then and sometimes it didn't come in again for 2 or 3 days. And on the other hand, they would sometimes send sacks and sacks and sacks of rice with no idea how long that had to last us, which was extremely serious, because to see, for the women who were pretty hungry by then, to be confronted with sacks of rice, their immediate idea was to eat it. But we didn't know how long it was supposed to last. It was very difficult to be able to ration it ourselves. We did want to ration it properly ourselves, but it was also uncertain and really, you know, disorganized. And sometimes, of course, we'd have very little, and then suddenly at night some more would come in or something, and sometimes something that had to be cooked immediately because we knew it wouldn't keep in the heat until the next day. So having thought that we'd had out all that we were going to get that day and provided ourselves with a meal, suddenly late at night would come some meat or something which couldn't possibly be kept until the morning, which had to be cooked immediately. It was really pretty trying. Mm. And apart from being counted morning and evening by somebody or other, they didn't really interfere a great deal in the way the camp was run.
What actually did the Japanese establishment in charge of the camp consist of? Can you remember?
Well, there was always somebody in charge. There was always an officer of some rank in charge. And then the guards, sometimes more than others, sometimes we were more settled than others. Sometimes the officer in charge would remain with us for quite a while. And then there seemed to be somebody else in sort of superior command who probably had charge of several camps, because he only appeared occasionally. And for a time, the one we had, well, we always said he seemed reasonable, but he would promise us everything we asked him. We'd ask him for this, that, and the next thing. And he would say, oh, yes, 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 I will see to that. But it never materialised. And in the end, we used to say, ask for what you like, says me Archie, but you'll never get it. Just to listen and say, yes, yes, you know, yes. Oh, yes, we needed that. He could see what we needed that. And but we never got it. But he seemed to be another one, I say, in sort of superior command to the one who was with us. I never got a hold of the ranks. I don't know who, but obviously there was the officer time. And then there were the guards. And strangely enough, it seemed that the Japs must have been terribly short of uniforms, because the guards wore the oddest assortment of uniform themselves. They were far from soldierly, as you would have imagined them, all dressed exactly the same in respectable clothes. I mean, sometimes they were patched and sometimes they were wearing clothes obviously either too big or too small for them, and so on. So that you know, I think they themselves were pretty short of supplies.
What sort of numbers were in evidence? How many of them were in charge in running the camp?
Well, I suppose there was about 5 or 6 guards at a time. Mostly they came round in twos, sometimes just one at a time. They seemed to take it in turns to come round.
And they'd operate in shifts of some kind, didn't
they? Yes, I'm sure they must have done.
How many shifts, do you remember?
No, not at all. Mm.
So the internees were largely left to their own devices. How then did they organise their affairs amongst themselves?
Well, first of all, they asked us, or the doctor was really taking charge. She was a very, very sensible Scottish woman. And being the doctor, I suppose she felt that it was up to her to suggest things. And she suggested that we had a committee to run the camp, which was sensible enough. And she asked us all in each house to elect a captain to speak for us, because obviously it was useless for us all to attend meetings, so that we were supposed to elect one person from every group, from every house, to represent us, and then to form a committee from those. We called those the captain, and then from those captains they elected a small committee to do the overall running. The food, of course, was the main thing, the food and the drains and things like that, things to do with the hygiene of the camp, which really was very necessary for somebody to have charge of. And so with the captains and then this smaller committee and the doctor, we ran the camp like that, and really quite well. So there was always somebody to oversee the rations when they came in, because obviously they used to come and just dump them on the road. Well, you couldn't have hundreds of people rushing at these rations, or else it would have been chaotic. So there was one of the committee was always there, and one was delegated to be sort of ration officer and to oversee the distribution and division. And the difficult part was that all these houses were not occupied by the same number of people, so that sometimes there were, say, 15 of us, 16 next door, 24 opposite, 11, and so on, different numbers. And then, by the wisdom of Solomon, this amount of rations had to be divided up as fairly as possible to give each house, each lot of people, an amount which was worked out fairly per person, which was very difficult, especially when they dump meat on the, just throw a chunk of meat on the ground. Well, supposedly red meat probably came off a yak or something. It was terribly tough old meat. And just on the bone, and people would be hacking at it with penknives and table knives to try and cut up this chunk of meat lying in the roadside and try and give pieces to all these different numbers of people. It was extremely difficult. Rice was easy enough. You could measure that. You could measure that out in some sort of container and give everybody a requisite amount of rice, that was dry rice. That was easy enough.
Yes.
But anything else, and then the vegetables, and sometimes there were so few that really you couldn't give one to every household, depending what it was. And eggs would come in sometimes. And there might be, by this time, there were over 400 of us. And supposing 30 eggs came in, what do you do with 30 eggs among 400 people? And all this had to be decided, and it was a very good thing that we were sensible enough to elect a committee and somebody who had the final say-so as to what happened to these things.
What form did the election of house captains take? And how often did you do it?
Well, it was quite amicable within each group of people. That usually, I think in most of the houses, there was somebody who was obviously more suited than another to represent them. I don't think they found any difficulty about it. And until for a few months, this worked out very well. Then later on, we went there April the 1st. By June, the Japs had insisted that we have somebody to whom they could talk. They didn't want a committee. They didn't want two or three people to talk to. And they demanded that we elected one person to be our spokeswoman. And so there was a real election. They wanted one from each side, a Dutch woman and an English woman, to represent the two sides of the camp. And so we did hold an election. Now, up till that time, the doctor had really been representing us, but the Japs wanted it more or less cut and dried, and they also sort of wanted the Dutch to be brought in. And so we had a real sort of election. And we just got all together, and they put us a few names up, and we voted for them just with a show of hands. Yes, I don't think we had enough paper to vote. I'm not sure. No, I believe we did scrape up enough paper to have a paper vote. But it turned out the same. There was a woman in the Dutch camp who was obviously the leader type, who had been looking after, she had been really leading the Dutch side, and she was elected. And our doctor, who'd been doing it all along, and now she was actually elected as as the leader. And so these two became the commandants, one of the Dutch, one of ours, to speak for us, and anything we wanted, we asked her about. But they still kept the committee that they'd originally elected, because it they had to have somebody to do oversee these various things of the camp. I think, considering that we were women, disorganized women, because, I mean, had we been army personnel as them in the men's camps, that was obvious. There was a senior officer always. The senior officer, he was in charge. That was it. And there were other officers, and they went down, and so they organized it just as if it was in the army. But when you consider that we were a heterogeneous collection of women coming from all types of background and all types of occupation and not knowing each other, and nobody having any precedence of rank or anything else, I think actually we got organised very quickly and very sensibly. Looking back on it, I really, you know, think that that we did very sensibly get ourselves organised very quickly.
When you elected house captains, did you elect them for once and all, or did you have regular elections?
No. If anything happened that the house captain wanted to step down, some of them, I believe, in some of the houses did for some reason, or they were ill, and then automatically somebody else would just step in. It wasn't anything very serious. Every household got to know each other, because we lived in such close proximity that everybody knew everybody so intimately in that time, and those people you were with, that it was very obvious who would be elected to just step in. I don't think any of the houses, even the most dissident of the houses, I don't think there was any difficulty about it.
Yes, but just to clear this up, were there regular elections, or was there just one election, and then that person served until they...
One election.
I see, fine. Apart from food, rations, what other aspects of camp life came under the administration of the camp committee?
Well, all these houses were attached to a septic tank, and septic tanks have to be emptied frequently, and especially when you consider that a septic tank in a bungalow was intended for a family of perhaps three or four at the most, and there were 30-odd using it. They overflowed very easily and very quickly, and they had to have a machine brought in to clean out these septic tanks very, very frequently. And so somebody obviously had to get onto the Japs to send this thing in to clear out the septic tanks. Some tanks, they didn't overflow all at once. So somebody would complain, our tank's overflowing, and rush to the committee and say, our tank's overflowing, do something about it. And then whoever it was on the committee whose job it was would go to the, or tell the commandant, and the commandant would get onto the Japs and say, we must have Neptune, we called it. Well, it had Neptune on the side of this thing, funnily enough. So they asked for Neptune to be sent in to clear the septic tanks. And this happened very frequently. Then in front of the houses, there was a drain, really, of course, there's torrential rain, tropical rain, so that beside the roads everywhere, there were very deep gullies, not such drains as we know in England, but really deep gullies to take rain that comes down torrentially. And these, of course, got overgrown with grass and so on in between the rains, and they had to be kept clear for when it did rain. Otherwise, we should have had the roads flooded, and the floods might have even gone into the houses. So they had to be kept cleared, and that was a job that somebody had to do.
Yes. Did the committee organise anything else?
No, I don't think so. Well, mainly the doctor, of course, the commandant, it fell on her shoulders to get onto the Japs to take anybody to hospital, because at that time, when we were in those houses, We weren't too far away from Palembang, where there was a hospital run by the nuns, and there were doctors there, Dutch doctors, who'd been left in charge, and that was running still as a hospital. And so if anybody had anything seriously wrong or anything we couldn't deal with in the camp, then they had to be taken to the hospital. And it ended by them organising sort of weekly sick parades, as it were, and getting the Japs to send in an ambulance or something to take them down to this hospital for treatment, and to keep in anybody who was really very sick. And that, of course, fell onto the committee and the doctor to organise. The Japs weren't interested. Well, they wouldn't have known anyhow, unless they'd been told that there was anybody who needed attention. Mm. Didn't always work, of course, and they didn't always send the ambulance as quickly as they should, nor on the days that they said they would, but roughly it worked while we were there.
So was there anything else that came under the committee's jurisdiction?
Well, that time, by the time most people had taken some money into the camp, which they'd been able to change into the local guilders, but a lot of people were running short of money, and some were completely destitute. We needed money so that we could buy from the shop that was allowed to come in once a week, which brought in fruit, which was badly needed because the Japs didn't give us fruit, and we did need this particularly to supplement the diet. And then at that time too, I'm talking still about these camp, which was the houses, they brought in a certain amount of other things, notebooks, pencils, soap, toothbrushes.
How did the committee get involved in this?
So the committee was involved with these people who'd run short of money, and so they organised one or two things, what they called a Red Cross sale. They started what they called a Red Cross fund to help these people who'd run short of money, and they organised a sale so that people put in anything that they could spare. If people had luggage, some people who'd taken in a bit of luggage, anything they could find there that could be sold to people who'd got money. And then this money was then given over to the people who'd become destitute. And they did try to look after the people who hadn't any money. Sometimes, I must say, wasn't quite legitimate, but still, that's another story.
What's another story?
Well, some people said they hadn't got money, when really what they didn't want to do was to sort of break into one woman said, well, yes, of course, I have got some English money, but then supposing we're released next week, I shall need that. Well, the point was, we had to change any money of any sort of currency into the local currency. Of course, we lost on the deal in the exchange, but money was money and should have been changed before they claimed to be destitute. If they'd got money, then the thing was, somehow or other, it should have been exchanged, and they shouldn't have called themselves destitute if they'd really got some currency of some sort. Unfortunately, I had a bank draft. That wasn't much good. A bank draft.
Did this create much ill will when situations like that arose?
Oh, very little, actually, no. I think it was just sort of one of those things, you know, that as we look upon it now, somebody always tries to get away with something. Mm.
What were relations like between the internees and the Japanese?
Well, I can't think that we had any relationship, actually. We got to know the guards, who were always nasty, and we got to know their little foibles, what annoyed them when we were lined up for Tenko. Some of them seemed to be annoyed about one thing, some about another. And trying to dodge having our faces slapped for misdemeanours, most of which we knew not of, we didn't know what we'd done. But we did get to know the foibles of most of them, what what things annoyed which guard, and we'd pass the word around and say, "Lipstick Larry's on tonight," and this sort of thing, you know, so that we'd warn people and they'd scrub any lipstick off. This was the early part when they'd got lipstick. And things like that, that, you know, some of them, as I say, they had their little foibles. And so we learned to get round those.
Give me some more examples of these little foibles.
Well, you know, if we whispered when we were, we dared to speak to one another while we were on parade, or didn't bow quickly enough or properly, and oh, that we turned out not, as they thought, not dressed properly, and oh, all sorts of things. And we got our hats on when we should have had hats off, and, you know, all sorts of things. Some of them didn't mind, but as I say, we had to get just used to which guard was on and what he was likely to complain about. And live round it as you do. You always find a way round things in the end, you know. You we watched to see who was going to take Tenko and send the word around. And
take
we
Tenko?
Try to avoid trouble.
What do you mean by take Tenko?
Tenko was roll call when they counted us. Good. And they just used to shout out, "Tenko, Tenko," and we'd all tumble out.
Yes. Now, did the Japanese hand out physical punishment pretty liberally?
Well, face-slapping, of course. This was, and always has been, I suppose, a Japanese form of reprisal. They think nothing of it. But, of course, it came as a terrible shock to us. And they did do that. And sometimes, I know once one girl...